Okay, I am recording, and we're. I guess could we stop? Could we start? I should say, with the background of your research, how long you've been doing it, how you got involved. This is just helpful for me when I write.
Sure.
Okay. Go ahead.
In 1960 is when I got started. That was the year that John Reynolds at Berkeley discovered some strange things in xenon isotopes and meteorites. I was a graduate student. Okay. I was at the University of Arkansas. I worked there. In fact, in 62, I was sent to Berkeley to work with John Reynolds to figure out how that instrument operated where he had made the discovery. And then when I finished my PhD degree, I postdoced with John Reynolds at Berkeley. Now, my PhD's in nuclear chemistry. I postdoced in the physics department. And then I came to UMR in 1964 in the fall and set up an instrument like John Reynolds had built and like I had set up for my PhD research at the University of Arkansas, and used that to study the abundances of isotopes in meteorites and lunar samples, and then compared that with data on isotopes in the solar wind and in solar flares and in different planets where we have data. So that's kind of the background. So I have over 40 years I've been involved in measurements of isotopes of elements. Now, I don't know if the audience will know what isotopes are, so maybe we ought to explain that. Isotopes are simply atoms of the same element that have slightly different masses because they have different numbers of neutrons in the nucleus. Okay, so for example, carbon consists of carbon 12, carbon 13, and there is a little carbon 14, which is radioactive and is made in the upper atmosphere. Okay, so most elements consist of atoms of different mass or isotopes. And by measuring those, we can see what was happening at the birth of the solar system. Okay. So beginning in 1960, John Reynolds found the decay product of a short-lived radioactivity. Iodine-129 had been trapped in meteorites when they formed. Since then, a lot of much shorter-lived radioactivities have been found. In fact, there are indications now that when the solar system formed, within a matter of minutes, we were making some separation of radioactivities that had been produced in a supernova. A lot of short-lived radioactivities were also trapped in meteorites. Now, I will go back and just summarize what the observations were. The observations were, number one, when the solar system formed, isotopes that were made in the parent star in different regions never got mixed. So, for example, what we first found in xenon was the heaviest isotope of xenon, which was xenon-136. It was in some places enriched by up to a factor of 2. Okay. The standard model for how did the solar system form claimed that this stuff was all a well-mixed interstellar cloud. The observations didn't fit. Now, over many decades, in fact, in essence, ever since I've been involved, what has happened to the scientific community is when their observations don't fit the standard model for how the solar system formed, scientists have been encouraged to use what I would call magical thinking to make up some catchy title for a discovery that will generate good PR and additional funding for NASA. Okay, so when excess xenon-136 was discovered in meteorites, and we reported that in Nature in 1972, we said, hey, this was a primordial xenon component that was here at the birth of the solar system, and it didn't look like the xenon here on Earth. But the catchy title that was invented to try to explain this was super heavy elements have been discovered in meteorites. That was wrong. It was blatantly wrong at the time. It continued to get good press and a lot of PR for about 12 years. Finally, in 1983, they admitted, oh, no, it wasn't super heavy element fission. It was interstellar diamonds trapped in meteorites. That's another example of magical thinking. It's a catchy title, gets good PR for NASA, and probably generates additional funding, but there is no evidence of any interstellar dust grains, including diamonds, stuck in meteorites. If you had interstellar diamonds stuck in meteorites, those interstellar diamonds would be older than the host meteorites that they got trapped in, and those interstellar diamonds would have been irradiated by cosmic rays as they traverse space before being incorporated in there. Those things have been looked for. There's no evidence of either one of them. So the material that formed the solar system was heterogeneous. In fact, it was debris of a supernova. And by 1975, we were rather certain that the solar system formed from the debris of a single star. All right, but it wasn't until 83, for example, that super heavy elements was finally abandoned as an explanation for some of the observations, and then another magical title came in, interstellar diamonds. Well, there aren't interstellar diamonds. There weren't super heavy elements. One good thing did come out of this super heavy element fiasco. Glenn Seaborg at Berkeley had been working very hard trying to make super heavy elements. He hadn't been able to make super heavy elements like those that were reported in meteorites. So he got very interested in that. And he became my friend as a result of that controversy. Any rate, by 1975, we were rather certain the sun had formed on the collapsed core of a supernova. But the problem was, if the sun formed that way, that's the conclusion we came to from studying meteorites. If the sun formed that way, it shouldn't have very much light elements. So things like hydrogen and helium, the things that make up over 99% of the elements at the sun's surface, should be very rare in the sun. Well, those are the two lightest elements. And so beginning in 83, we started looking at particles coming out of the sun to try to figure out, was the surface of the sun, in fact, the same as what was inside? That is, by measuring isotopes of elements coming out of the sun, what we wanted to see was, is there maybe some process that's enriching the lightest elements, hydrogen and helium, at the surface of the sun? So we took lunar dirt, measured isotopes implanted in that, and what we found was for every element, the lighter atoms were systematically enriched relative to heavier atoms. All right? We saw that in helium, we saw it in neon, we saw it in argon, we saw it in krypton, we saw it in xenon, and that all fit one very simple equation. You could fit this mass separation that was had separated the isotopes of these elements. When you apply that simple equation to the abundance of elements in the sun's atmosphere or photosphere, when you correct that for this mass separation that we see across the isotopes of all the elements, what you get is that the most abundant elements in the sun are not hydrogen and helium, as the surface shows. The most abundant elements are iron, nickel, oxygen, silicon, sulfur, magnesium, and calcium. Now, that finding, you could say, well, yeah, that just assumes that if your correction for mass separation is correct, So maybe, in fact, what you saw in lunar dirt was a coincidence. But if you go back and read a 1917 paper by a fellow named William Harkins, he tried to figure out what's the most abundant elements. He analyzed, by wet chemical analysis, like 357 meteorites. He found seven elements that have even atomic numbers comprise 99% of all the material in ordinary meteorites. And those seven elements were the same seven elements that we found to comprise in the bulk of the sun. Okay, so the probability of that being a coincidence is, in essence, zero. In fact, it's so small, and you can calculate the probability that this equation that fits isotope ratios, the probability that equation would select from the photosphere the same seven elements that Harkins found to comprise 99% of meteorites is, you'd put a zero, and then put a period, then you'd write 32 other zeros, and then put a two, and that number would be bigger than the probability of this thing being a coincidence. So it's over. The sun's mostly iron. There's no doubt of that. Okay, but it unfortunately doesn't provide some catchy title that fits. It can be used to hang on to the old idea that the sun formed as a homogeneous body and the solar system formed out of an interstellar cloud. That simply isn't true.
So is it accepted by the scientific community now that the sun is mostly a ball of iron?
No.
It is not?
It is not. The accepted explanation is that what's called the standard solar model. And the what really happened was man discovered hydrogen fusion at the end of World War II. Then astronomers realized they could explain a long-standing puzzle. What makes the sun shine? The scientific community couldn't explain that until hydrogen fusion was discovered. Then scientists said, hey, if the inside of the sun has the same composition as its surface, we can tell people that hydrogen fusion in the inside of the sun is making the sun shine. Okay? But there was a problem. If the sun formed by accretion of material, the sun would segregate as it was forming. Lighter elements would float to the surface. So there was no way for the surface of the sun to have the same composition as as its interior if the sun formed as every other object that we know of forms, that is, by accreting material. So the standard solar model simply assumes the sun formed instantly as a homogeneous body, thoroughly mixed without any accretion of matter. That's another example. In fact, that's the root cause of this magical thinking that's plagued the scientific community, the space science community. Okay? As you probably know, since the 1960s, there's been measurements made to show that hydrogen fusion was the source of the sun's energy. So the explanation was, just give us a few million dollars, we will measure neutrinos coming out of the sun, and we'll show that it's hydrogen fusion. The measurements were made. The number of neutrinos observed were less than those predicted. So now there's another catchy title to explain this. It's called oscillating neutrinos. So the story is, the right number of neutrinos are made in the sun, but by the time they reach our detectors here on Earth, the neutrinos change character and become something different than what was produced. Okay? So at any rate, the story of the hydrogen-rich sun, in my opinion, it's just an example of magical thinking. To think that the surface of the sun would have the same composition of its interior, and that light elements wouldn't float to the surface of the sun, would require some very strange, most unusual set of events. As far as I know, no one has ever observed anything like this, a body the size of the sun forming instantaneously thoroughly mixed. Okay? It's not anything observed. It's something that if you can't observe, you can just assume it, and then you can tell people you've explained a major scientific problem, which is what makes sunshine. Now, let me go one step further. The old problem is, long before NASA even came into existence, what makes sunshine? We think we have that explained also. Okay? That is, the sun formed on the collapsed core of a supernova. It accreted a bunch of iron-rich material, just like the material that formed those planets close to the sun. For example, Mercury is 60% iron. Okay? And mostly it accreted material much like that. Okay? But in the core of the sun is the collapsed core of a supernova, which is a neutron star. That neutron star, and we've done the calculations based on nuclear physics, that neutron star is emitting neutrons. The neutrons are decaying the hydrogen atoms, and they do that in about 10 minutes. Hydrogen atoms move up to the surface of the sun. On their way up, 99% are consumed by fusion. That produces those fusion reactions as these particles are moving up from the core of the sun. That fusion generates less than about 38% of the sun's energy. Okay? Most of the energy is generated just when neutrons are emitted from this neutron star at the core of the sun. At any rate, the neutrons are emitted from the core. They move to the surface, 99% is consumed by fusion, but every year a huge number of hydrogen atoms reach the surface and go flying off into space in what we call the solar wind. Now, that number is a huge number each year that leaves the sun, but if you take that number, you can calculate back, you can explain that. You can explain solar luminosity, and you get the right solar neutrino flux from the model we've proposed, and we don't have to have neutrinos oscillating.
Now, with SOHO being in position, isn't it? Can't that be used to help bring this controversy to an end?
Well, I hope so. I hope so. In fact, I was at a SOHO conference in 2001 in Bern, Switzerland, and I went over there and told them the sun's mostly iron. The response was my paper was excluded from the proceedings. Okay, so if they get serious about science, you understand science has been corrupted. It's become not a search for truth, but a search for funds. The question is, how do you keep grant funds flowing, and how do you keep the agency getting more money from the funding from Congress so we can keep this machine moving? Okay. Any rate, yes, SOHO might, and in fact, we have proposed specific tests for our model. One, when neutrons decay to hydrogen atoms, and we've told them how many there will be, there should be antineutrinos produced in the sun. In fact, there are detectors right now that should be able to detect those. And they may have to be modified slightly, but this neutrino detector, this is the Homestake mine, could, by looking for chlorine-35 being converted to sulfur-35, could check to see if there are, not neutrinos, but antineutrinos. If they're there, then the standard solar model's wrong. That's all. Okay? And that's a measurement that could easily be done. Okay? They could look for evidence of the exotic magnetic fields, circular polarized light, or some quadrupole moment from this dense, compact neutron star that we think is at the core of the sun. SOHO should be able to look for those things. Okay? We've also told them that the solar wind moves away from the sun much faster at the poles than it does at the equator. We've told them to look there because heavy elements should be enriched in abundance at the poles. Okay? They have already seen many indications that in fact the sun is chemically layered, that the surface isn't the same as the inside. And let me just tell you, measurements they already have, they've chosen to try to use magical thinking to explain. One of those things is there is too much lithium-6 and too much beryllium-10 in the solar wind for the surface of the sun to represent what's inside. Another measurement that they've had for many years is they've seen that the ratio of nitrogen-15 to nitrogen-14 has increased with time. Well, their standard solar model, that thing shouldn't have been increased with time. There isn't any way they should see that, but it's an experimental observation. All right. There's another experimental observation. In solar flares, particles come out of the sun kind of in a squirt, and heavy elements are highly enriched. That also tells us the surface of the sun isn't the same as the inside. Okay? So the measurements are already there. What we need to do is to kind of end the magical thinking. If anyone who thinks that the sun is mostly hydrogen is willing to publicly debate with me and to address the experimental observations, I'll be happy to outline them. And we'll see if they can, in fact, explain the experimental data.
So, are you making any headway into that happening?
Well, yes. Uh-huh. In fact, I was invited to a conference in Oulu, Finland, to give a plenary talk on the standard solar model versus experimental observations. That was like in June. At the end of July, I was at a meeting of the Meteoritical Society at UCLA, where I presented a paper, Why the Model of a Hydrogen-Filled Sun is Obsolete. From there, I went to Berlin, Germany, where I presented a paper on experimental evidence in meteorites telling us that the sun is not a ball of hydrogen. Okay, so yes, we're making headway, but unfortunately, some members of the scientific community seem to think that instead of addressing the observations, they can make snide comments like this is junk science. Well, my conclusions are based on 40 years of measurements, and if anyone thinks my conclusions are wrong, as I said, let them put their money where their mouth is. Let them appear on TV with me, and we'll make an outline of the observations, and they can tell us how the standard model explains them.
Am I misinterpreting this, or does it appear that acceptance of this idea seems greater outside the United States?
No, you're not wrong. In fact. When I told over the years, we ran into an enormous kind of roadblock in the United States, and I think it's no one's fault. It's because of the way the system works. To get funding to do research, you need to say things that agrees with what the bulk of the scientific community thinks, and things that's going to help the federal agencies get more money. Okay, and if what you say flies in the face of conventional thinking, then the tendency is to try to shut you up, to deny you funding, and to hope you'll go away. But, for example, we published 3 papers this year from Budapest, Hungary. Well, we published them there because we knew that was a place we could they were willing to consider the scientific evidence, measure that, review the papers. They were subject to review, but review the papers and then publish. And as I said, but we've published papers over the years, over the decades. We've published in Nature, we've published in Science, we've published in Meteoritics, we've published in Journal of Inorganic Nuclear Chemistry, we've published in Journal of Fusion Energy. There's a broad gamut, Journal of Geochemical Society. There's a broad range. So the scientific community can't claim that, oh, they never heard of this before. If they didn't hear about it before, it's because they weren't paying attention, okay? And if any one of them, as I said, wants to publicly debate and explain how the standard model will fit the observations, I'll be very happy to appear with any of them anywhere. But I will insist that we aren't going to stand up there and use catchy titles and magical thinking to try to avoid dealing with the observations.
So what's the next step? You just have to keep at this, don't you?
Next step was to interview you. No.
But
honestly, the next step is if you can get the story out in enough places, you can force the scientific community to address the observations. That's the whole key to getting this resolved. All right, let's assume that my story is wrong. Let's assume that the standard solar model is right. Then the way to show that is to let the defenders of that appear, address the observations, and explain them, rather than avoiding the observations and using such cheap phrases as junk science to try to dismiss. Okay? 40 years of measurements aren't going to go away.
I think the thing that disturbs me about this is that historically,
mm-hmm.
Scientists have had to recant, you know, definitive
sure.
statements over and over and over again.
Sure.
So to keep going in back into the behavior of, you know, this is an absolute and you're not going to change my way of thinking.
Oh, nothing is an absolute. Well, in the first place, science is kind of a search to get closer to truth. We never have truth. And if we had it, we wouldn't know it. Okay? But by repeated measurements and doing different tests, you can get closer to truth. Okay? So do I have truth? Does the opposing position have truth? Well, heck, neither one of us know that. The way to find out which one's closer is to address the experimental measurements. Okay. One way to address them is say, well, this measurement's wrong. But the measurements were not just made here. The measurements were made in some of the labs all over the world. Okay. So all I'm telling you is the measurements I refer to, many of them were made here. Many of them have been confirmed, like in Mainz, Germany, Washington University, University of Chicago, Caltech. You can't wiggle out by saying the measurements aren't good, okay?
Is there anything I haven't asked you about this that I should have?
Not that I know of. Oh, well, one thing I would like to put in a plug for Glenn Seaborg in about 76. They were, at that time, the space science community was saying they had discovered super heavy elements in meteorites. Glenn Seaborg had been trying to make super heavy elements out in Berkeley. So he got very interested. At any rate, in 1999, shortly before he died, he and I were organizing an ACS, the American Chemical Society symposium, on the origin of elements in the solar system. The purpose of that was to try to bypass some of this game playing and make a permanent record of ideas about the origin of the solar system and the origin of its elements as the 20th century was coming to an end. Glenn Seaborg died shortly before the conference began, but he invited many of the speakers. We did have the conference. We did publish the proceedings. Kluwer Plenum Press published the proceedings. If anyone's interested in seeing observations, and the speakers included people on both sides of this argument, okay, if anyone's interested in that, as I said, the proceedings are available from Kluwer Plenum Press, and it's simply shows the experimental observations and different people's ideas about them.
I just now need you to state your name and title, so I have that on the tape.
My name's Oliver Manuel. I am an emeritus professor of nuclear chemistry at the University of Missouri Rolla.
Once I get this produced, I will burn a copy on a CD and send it to you.
And
okay.
Send it to some of those who think they can explain the observations.
Hey, give me names and addresses and I will.
I'll be happy to.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.